What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is the best-selling author and influential speaker, Rabbi Joseph Telushkin. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. We are now in the last couple of weeks of the Jewish year of 5774 and moving rapidly towards the new year of 5775. In Jewish tradition, this month of Elul is the time to begin taking stock of our lives, examining our character, and seeking to return to our families and to the best that is within us. Over the course of this month, and even more in the 10 days of repentance from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, we endeavor to repair all that is damaged in our lives or has become damaged over the past 12 months. It's a challenging time of year, but also a very powerful one, filled with the potential to truly change our lives for the good. Heady stuff. Change is always challenging, even when it is for the better. Generally speaking, it's easier to do the same things over again the same way. We already know how to do what we've already done. And even if the results aren't fulfilling or meaningful, they are predictable. That's why so many of us find it nearly impossible to make significant changes in our personal lives and conduct. But the danger is that we will just do what we've always done and arrive next year at Rosh Hashanah and discover we've made the same mistakes and again failed to improve our lives. Albert Einstein's definition of insanity was doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. This very special time of year gives us a chance to choose to live better, holier, more meaningful lives. And all that we have to do is look in the mirror honestly and see that reflected there is someone who has the capacity to become more than he or she was over the last 12 months. And then to act to make that happen. To play us in on this morning in the month of Elul in preparation for the coming High Holy Day season, here's the Metropolitan Opera tenor and cantor Jan Pierce singing the classic High Holy Day prayer Avinu Malkeinu with Max Janowski's famous setting.
Avinu Malkeinu Shma Koleinu Avinu Malkeinu Chotanu lefonecho Avinu Malkeinu Chamol oleinu Ve'yal oleinu Ve'tapeinu
Avinu Malkeinu
Shalom.
That was cantor and operatic tenor Jan Pierce singing the classic prayer of the High Holy Day season, Avinu Malkeinu, Our Father, Our King. Rosh Hashanah is now just 2.5 weeks away. Well, while the world has been focused on Islamist atrocities in Iraq, or on ceasefires that either exist or don't in Ukraine and Gaza, there was some very interesting historical information that the U.S. government made available last week. In a surprising move, the Obama administration declassified some 45-year-old top-secret papers that document contacts between Jerusalem and Washington over how America decided to agree to the existence of an Israeli nuclear option. The Interagency Security Classification Appeals Panel, which is in charge of approving the declassification of U.S. government documents, refused to declassify these secrets of the Israeli nuclear program for more than 4 decades, actually 4.5. But now, for reasons that aren't clear, they were made available this past week, close to their 45th anniversary. These documents outline how the American executive branch worked to prepare for a meeting between President Richard Nixon and Prime Minister Golda Meir at the White House in September of 1969. As the officials worked and argued, they eventually came to terms with a 3-part Israeli refusal: a refusal to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, a refusal to agree to American inspection of the Dimona nuclear facility, and a refusal to condition delivery of U.S. military equipment on Israel's agreement to give up nuclear weaponry in exchange for strategic ground-to-ground missiles capable of reaching most Arab capitals. The officials, cabinet secretaries, and senior advisors eventually withdrew from what originally was a plan to block Israel's nuclearization. Under the leadership of then Undersecretary of State Joseph Sisko, they finally acceded, in internal correspondence anyway, to recognize Israel as a threshold nuclear state. Interestingly, the content of the direct conversations between Nixon and Golda Meir is still classified. But since this was Nixon, you know it had to be taped. Anyway, according to the U.S. documents we do have, the Nixon administration defined a double threshold for Israel's move from a technical option to a possessor of nuclear weapons. The first threshold was having the components of nuclear weapons that will explode and making them part of the IDF's operational inventory. The second threshold was public confirmation of suspicions of the existence of nuclear weapons in Israel by testing or making public the fact that it had them. Officials under Nixon finally proposed to him, just on the eve of his September 69 conversation with Golda Meir, that Nixon show restraint with regard to the Israeli nuclear program and abandon efforts to get Israel to stop acquiring 500-kilometer-range missiles with 110 warheads from France that could be used to deliver nuclear warheads to enemy capitals. Israel's policy of nuclear ambiguity, which still does not categorically confirm or deny its nuclear ability, appears to be as much an outcome of the Nixon-Meir understanding as it was an originally Israeli concept. The declassified material deals with things that happened in 1969 and 1968, the end of the terms of President Lyndon Johnson and Prime Minister Levi Eshkol, and the beginning of the Nixon-Golda Meir era, but there are some contemporary lessons for us. Among these are the importance of the personal relationship between any American president and any Israeli prime minister, clearly an important part of the developing relationship that existed between America and Israel at that time. This highlights the less-than-perfect relationship between Barack Obama and Bibi Netanyahu today. The other issues that are still relevant today are the American guarantees of Israeli security, the supplying of weapons to Israel, and the acceptance of Israel's nuclear status. These documents also shed light on the way America might respond to the possibility that another country, like Iran, could move ahead gradually towards nuclear weapons, but remain on the threshold, not quite there, of having functional nuclear weapons without ever making it explicit. A lot of these documents are fascinating as history. Back in the summer of 69, there was an internal Nixon administration debate between the Department of Defense under Melvin Laird, which opposed Israel becoming nuclear, and the Department of State, which took a much softer line. In addition, there was disagreement among the Americans over the extent of Israel's progress towards a nuclear weapon. The Department of State under William Rogers and relying on the CIA under Richard Helms strongly doubted that they were close. State Department memo read, "This final step, having a nuclear bomb that is one we believe Israel would like to avoid. The fierce determination to safeguard the Jewish people, however, makes it probable that Israel would desire to maintain the ultimate weapon at hand, should its security again be seriously threatened." The Department of Defense in 1969, based on its own intelligence agency's work, was more decisive when it evaluated that Israel had already gotten nuclear weapons. They were likely more accurate, too. Then Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Yitzhak Rabin, with his military record and his experience in talks on arms supplies with the Johnson administration, was the key guy on the Israeli side in the nuclear discussions. Even though the final decisions were supposed to be made in Jerusalem by Golda Meir, Moshe Dayan, and Abba Iban, the Johnson and Nixon administrations concluded eventually that in talks with Rabin, it was stated in a manner explicit and implicit that Israel wants nuclear weapons for two reasons. First, to deter the Arabs from striking Israel. And second, if deterrence fails and Israel is about to be overrun, to destroy the Arabs in a nuclear Armageddon. It's fascinating, even if it's 45-year-old history, but it sheds light not only on why Israel developed nuclear weapons, a nuclear option, but why it still feels it needs to be the only nuclear power in the Middle East, which I think we should agree on. The immediate question is, why did the Obama administration declassify these documents now? We may never learn. It is a pleasure and a privilege to be able to welcome back to Two Jewish a very popular and distinguished guest, Rabbi Joseph Telushkin, the best-selling author of Jewish Literacy and many other books on Jewish life and ethics, and a charming and interesting guy. He has a new book out on a man he calls the most influential rabbi in modern history. Find out who it is and why when we return in a few moments right here on Two Jewish.
A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 15th anniversary with a special family class and in new locations. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. It's your turn. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not, and we feed you too. Rabbis Sam Kohan and Rabbi Batsheva Appel lead an open, interactive exploration of the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Classes are offered all over the Tucson area, and enrollment is easy. Call 520-327-4501 to sign up, or go to our website, templeemmanueltucson.org. The class includes delicious taste of traditional Jewish foods. It's free and open to all, regardless of religious background. But please, pre-enroll by calling 520-327-4501. Taste of Judaism has both daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, East Tucson, and Green Valley, and the very popular Taste of Judaism family class held at Tucson Hebrew Academy. It's a great learning opportunity for the whole family. There's no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 520-327-4501 for more information and to register today for Taste of Judaism.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our very special guest this morning, Rabbi Joseph Telushkin, who is one of the best-selling and most influential Jewish authors today and for the last, several decades. He has a new book out called Rebbe, about the Chabad Lubavitch Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson. And, it's always an honor to talk to you, and this is a particularly interesting subject for you have written on. Welcome to Two Jewish.
Oh, thank you. I am always happy to be with you.
So you have a personal connection, or had a personal connection to the Rebbe. Can you share that story with us?
Yes, the connection was more familial than directly personal, but it's very close familial. My father, Shlomo Telushkin, of blessed memory, was for over 40 years the accountant for the Rebbe, the main accountant for the movement, and even for the previous Rebbe. And my grandfather, who was a prominent rabbi, had a very close relationship with the Rebbe. And I tell the story in the book. For all I know, this might have been a factor in why I ended up writing this book. In 1986, I was living in Israel, and I received a call from my mom that my father had had a stroke. I flew back immediately. He was in a coma, and every day we were getting two calls from the Rebbe's office. The Rebbe wants to know how your father is. He came out of the coma. He was in ICU, intensive care, and a few days later, I continue to get those calls. But then one day, the call is from Rabbi Krinsky, who is the Rebbe's, one of his very senior aides. And he said, the Rebbe has an accounting question for your father. And I said, you know how sick my father is? And Rabbi Krinsky said, of course we know, and the Rebbe knows, but nonetheless, he asked us to ask your father this question. I went in and I asked my father. He looked at me a bit surprised and then gave me what the answer was. And I was profoundly moved because I realized what had happened. My father was like a man running full speed into a brick wall. In one day, his accounting career, he was 80, but a very vibrant 80. In one day, his accounting career had come to an end. His weekly Talmud shiur that he gave, he could no longer give. And the Rebbe, sitting there in his office in Brooklyn with numerous responsibilities, was thinking about the fact how vulnerable my father must have felt. And so he came up with a question that my father could answer. And by doing so, reminded my father he still had a role to play. And the fact that the Rebbe was known for his love of Jews in general and what Chabad does is moving. But the fact to which, even as a leader, he stayed focused on the individual is what made so profound an impression on me.
It's an extraordinary story, and it illustrates something remarkable, not only about the character of the Rebbe, but also highlights something that becomes important in the way that he conducted his professional career, which was so influential. We will talk much more with Rabbi Joseph Telushkin when we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Now I want to express my thanks. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm glad and grateful that the modest cash awards we started with some 10 years ago have grown into a rather substantial amount with the help of donors like many of you. The Kohan Foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan of blessed memory, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the whole Jewish people. That service can be in one of four areas: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. Our past award winners include some truly amazing people, and we are grateful for the chance to reward them and their fine work. Do you know of someone who could qualify for a Kohan Award in 2015? Or will you consider participating in this work yourself? Please go to our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-Award.com, where you can find all the information on nominating and on participating in this great work. And we'll be glad to hear from you. Our goal is to help people who work for the whole Jewish people.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Cohan. Part of it is the cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes. Propylene glycol, vegetable glycerine, flavorings from Flavor Art in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or from the Apple iTunes Store, even better, as very popular Jewish podcasts. Rabbi Joseph Telushkin, our guest this morning, will be speaking at the Jewish Community Center here in Tucson on Monday, September 15th. You can hear him there by calling 520-299-3000 at the J or going to their website, tucsonjcc.org. He is outstanding in person, too. It's sponsored by Chabad. That's 299-3000 to hear Rabbi Joseph Telushkin live in Tucson on the 15th. Our Jewish Poetry Slam for the month of Elul, the final month of the Jewish year, and this period of time in which we begin the self-evaluation that culminates with the Jewish High Holy Days, the 10 days of return and repentance, the Aseret Yemei Teshuvah, with Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Debbie Perlman has a lovely poem in her book of modern psalms for the month of Elul, based on Psalm 94. Fighting the languor of sultry days, we begin the turning back to you. Moving against the heat of our hearts, against the anger inside, we turn. Call us to begin the examination, healing God. Call for us to remove the garment of our deceit, the fears that bind us away from you, chafing at our tender miseries. In the month of Elul, we uncover our secrets, examining them with a truthful heart, counting the pulse beats of our life, the selfish pressures we apply and resist. Call us to the consultation of our souls, for you are a God of healing and mercy. Call us to begin without delay, that Elul might draw us near to you. That was Debbie Perlman's poem for this month of return, Elul. Remember, Rosh Hashanah begins September 24th, now a little more than 2 weeks away. We welcome our Mivi Na'an Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So, we both have children. I had the privilege of having Shabbat dinner at your home. And I can tell you that although these are all Jewish children we're talking about, there is a difference in the way they're raised. In America, there's a certain structure to how kids are supposed to behave, even though I think we are more... we're looser about it than many countries in Europe. Tell me how you can recognize your daughter when she's in a kindergarten class or in a school class.
I was focused on Shira. She's 4. And last year when it came, she was 3. And every time I went to the JCC, I didn't have any hard time to recognize Demiri's class because I would see like a line of kids, you know, walking in a very, you know, like soldiers, and then I will see hands in the air, and she will be, you know,
off to the other side,
and I will recognize from a while away that this is my Demiri's class, and this is my daughter, and sometimes I can hear because I'm having a lot of, you know, meeting at the art gallery, the JCC, so I will hear her from, you know, when they are coming from the playground upstairs. I will hear, and I know this is Demiri's class. Yeah.
So that speaks to, I remember when my son was very little, he's now in college, and he couldn't move up a class because he didn't really know how to line up. Do they teach kids how to line up in Israel?
Are you kidding? What is line up? No, actually, no. And, you know, we just had a nice conversation before, and I share with you that my three girls were raised in a kibbutz. And I've sent them to this kibbutz because I like the way they educate kids in a very, like just... go with them, go out with them and let them explore in, you know, in their eyes. They won't give too much instruction, like, look at this flower or look at this butterfly. I think the teacher enjoy learning from their eyes. And that's why I loved so much that kids will be able to go any direction. Of course, they will have like 3-4 teachers to accompany, and it's in a kibbutz, so it's a, you know, it's something that they
finite
can control.
Space, they can't really get away.
No cars, no that. So it's really, really, how do you say, optimistic place for kids to grow up.
Ideal
that's
place.
Why we moved,
yeah,
you know, from 2 stories, a huge house, to a 60 meters. So
tiny place.
So the kids, so my kids will grow up freely. By the way, this freedom cost me a lot here, you know, because it's not.
It doesn't fit.
No, it doesn't fit here, but, you know.
It's okay. It's a price you pay. So Israel is known as a highly innovative nation, right? Startup nation and creativity. And, in fact, even the Israeli army, we used to say that you could tell the Israeli army they didn't know how to march. They only knew how to fight. Is there something special about that? It seems kind of Jewish not to walk in an even line because it won't get you there first.
I do feel that it relates to two main things. First, of course, our Jewish heritage of not taking anything for granted and to question. And even you, if you get 100 answers, you will keep questioning.
Keep asking.
And the other one is it's the educational system that was at the beginning, you know, of Israel, like 66 years ago, were based on the kibbutz
model and the
Moshe model. So that's really gave kids a lot of opportunity to really freely think. You know that the kibbutzim were started their day 6 a.m. taking all the kids to see birds, or so really like inspiring their days, and then they will eat breakfast.
Yeah.
They will earn their breakfast. So, you know, I think that's and of course the political fact that we are surrounded by friendly neighbors.
Yeah,
but we won't go there today.
Need a little creativity. Thanks, Ashrod. We will talk next week.
Thank you.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking about the Middle East today, which is a changed and changing and troubling and sometimes tragic area yet again. Last week, we focused on the destruction of Christian communities and the persecution of Christians by ISIS within the Syrian civil war, really all around the region. Let's talk a little bit about the role of Saudi Arabia today, and maybe its role not only in the current conflicts, but what kind of place it's looking out for itself now.
Sure. The case of Saudi Arabia is particularly difficult, complicated, but also particularly important because it has so much money and is such a close ally of the U.S. And what most Americans don't seem to understand is when we ask the question, why do they hate us? Why do they target us so much? Part of the answer is specifically that the Saudi royal family retains its hold on power because of our unquestioning support, financial, political, military, and otherwise. And a lot of Saudis and other Arabs see it as a repressive, overly conservative, backward-looking regime that's also entirely hypocritical. In other words, they won't let women drive. They won't let women hold political office. But they will go off to Las Vegas in private planes and hire hookers and showgirls.
Well, or to France, actually, for that matter. Lots
right.
of stories about that.
Or even Cairo.
Right.
If they want to stay close to home. So there's a lot of hypocrisy there. And although I hate to make it sound like the New York Times is my primary source of news, another really good editorial recently asked the question about Salafism, which is supported actively by Saudis and represents an extremist version of Islam, which is slowly throughout the Islamic world, not only in the Arab world, but everywhere from Indonesia to Bosnia, slowly replacing traditional, moderate, sort of go along to get along to go along types of Islam that that for centuries existed in these places and promoted moderation in all things and would have been recognizable to the Prophet Muhammad. What the Salafis and some of the other extremists,
like the Wahhabis,
advocate,
right,
what they teach, what they preach in their schools, what the Saudis are trying to export, is a version of Islam that would hardly be recognizable to Muhammad and that is highly hostile to Western values of pluralism, democracy, fundamental human rights, equal rights for women and minorities, et cetera, et cetera. And the Saudis pour billions of dollars a year into exporting these extreme versions of Islam, which are a tiny minority, really, and not true to the vast majority of Muslims historically. But instead of feeding and educating their own people and providing good medical care and developing their own country, they're exporting a brand of Islam that they don't really practice themselves, but that is dangerous for Westerners and spawns movements like ISIS, for example. So we see these horrific beheadings and tragedies throughout the Islamic
crucifixions,
world.
Crucifixions, I mean, crazy stuff.
But interestingly, what's happening now is that a lot of Arab countries are, to the extent that they have governments, and that's a question we'll discuss next week, trying to combat this form of Saudi extremism, of Muslim extremism, and other forms of Islamic extremism, including Hamas, upon which many Arab states are coming down pretty hard these days.
Fascinating. And we'll talk also about some changes in those Arab states, if you will, and some of the moderation that might be appearing next week. Thanks, Tom.
Sure.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One day the cantor, the chazan, was bragging and boasting about the quality of his voice. He told the rabbi, "Do you know that I even insured my great voice for $1 million? And the rabbi replied, "So what have you done with the money?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature, Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And only a guy who's a rabbi and a cantor can tell that joke. And now a word of Torah. How do we go about changing the world? And how long should it take? Our Torah portion, Ki Tavo, gives us powerful commandments about how we are to live in society. We're commanded to be moral, to protect the rights of the impoverished, the widow, the stranger. We are to be honest in business, careful of the needs of the hungry and the homeless. We are to create a society of ethical practice and moral concern. We are to understand that a nation is judged by how it treats its weakest, neediest members. We are told repeatedly that God knows and expects us to live to this covenant, to uphold it, to cherish it, to make it our own. And we are told of the blessings that will be ours if we can do this, and the curses we bring on ourselves if we cannot. This covenant was large and challenging. It put real responsibilities on its members, its B'nai B'rit, to do things that weren't easy or obvious, even if they were right. No doubt our ancient Israelite ancestors sometimes struggled when told to open your hands to the poor and the needy, to welcome the stranger, to love your neighbor as you love yourself. Probably they didn't always manage to give their full tithes, to make the pilgrimage to the temple in Jerusalem, to declare their gratitude for what they had. I'll even bet there were times when they didn't provide adequately for the widow or the orphan. But that challenge, the daily requirement to try to live to this standard, nonetheless made them better people, made Jewish society egalitarian and generally ethical. And when they failed, they learned that what God wanted was tshuva, return to the right course. Positive societal change was not instantaneous but evolutionary. But it did happen for our ancestors and was codified as a practical framework by the rabbis in the Talmud. And it can happen for us, too. In the wake of the terrible racial tsoras in Ferguson, Missouri, at a time when anti-immigrant sentiment seems to be flourishing against even unaccompanied children arriving in this country, when mercy is in short supply and justice does not always seem to be the prevailing condition of America, Ki Tavo reminds us that we can and should be better. And if we live to the standard of our best instincts, we will find that we can bring positive change to our society right now, and so bring blessing to our world. Our outstanding guest today, Rabbi Joseph Telushkin, will tell us what made the subject of his new book so compelling and so extraordinarily influential all across the Jewish world. Find out when we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 15th anniversary with a special family class and in new locations. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. It's your turn. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not, and we feed you too. Rabbis Sam Kohan and Rabbi Batsheva Appel lead an open, interactive exploration of the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Classes are offered all over the Tucson area, and enrollment is easy. Call 520-327-4501 to sign up, or go to our website, TempleEmmanuelTucson.org. The class includes delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. It's free and open to all, regardless of religious background. But please, pre-enroll by calling 520-327-4501. Taste of Judaism has both daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, East Tucson, and Green Valley, and the very popular Taste of Judaism family class held at Tucson Hebrew Academy. It's a great learning opportunity for the whole family. There's no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 520-327-4501 for more information and to register today for Taste of Judaism.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
An Islamic State video showing the beheading of American Jewish journalist Stephen Sotloff and reprisals, supposedly, for U.S. airstrikes in Iraq was released, and it has been authenticated by the U.S. government. An Israeli foreign ministry spokesman confirmed that Stephen Sotloff was a dual American-Israeli citizen. The Islamic State terrorist group released the video of the beheading last week. In the video, a masked figure also issued a threat against a third captive of Britain and warned governments to back off this evil alliance of America against the Islamic State. The executioner appeared to be the same British-accented guy who was in an August 19th video showing the killing of an American journalist, James Foley. In both videos, the captives were dressed in orange jumpsuits. "I'm back, Obama, and I'm back because of your arrogant foreign policy towards the Islamic State, because of your insistence on continuing your bombings and on Mosul Dam, despite our serious warnings," the man said. "So just as your missiles continue to strike our people, our knife will continue to strike the necks of your people." In the video, Sotloff describes himself as paying a price for the U.S. intervention in Iraq with his life. President Obama said that the U.S. will not be intimidated by Islamic State terrorists after the beheading of a second American journalist and will build a coalition to degrade and destroy them. Sotloff, a freelance journalist, was kidnapped in Syria a little over a year ago in August 2013. He grew up at Temple Beth Am in Miami, Florida, attending the Jewish day school there where his mother Shirley taught for many years. On August 27th, Sotloff's mother appealed in a videotaped message to Islamic State's self-proclaimed caliph, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, for her son's release. Addressing the leader of the Islamic State group by name, Shirley Sotloff said, in a video, that her son was an innocent journalist who shouldn't pay for the U.S. government's actions in the Middle East, over which he has no control. About 2 weeks ago, the Islamic State, formerly known as ISIS, released a video showing the beheading of James Foley, who had gone missing in Syria 2 years ago, and images of Sotloff in an orange jumpsuit. After his abduction, his family had tried to enforce a news blackout. The theory, apparently, is that by putting the journalist in the international spotlight, the kidnappers will assume they've got somebody high profile, will extort ever higher sums for the captive's release. He has now been murdered, tragically, brutally, another criminal act of these Islamists. May he rest in peace. May his memory be a blessing, and may it end soon.
Like most actors, my real job is saving the world. Start with plain water, add bubbles, mix in the perfect flavor. Look, a soda that's better for you and all of us. Less sugar, less bottles. If only I could make this message go viral.
Whoa, whoa, you doing it, Scarlett. Yeah, you doing it. Changing the world, one sip at a time.
Sorry, Coke and Pepsi.
Oh yeah, she done it. SodaStream.
Around the Super Bowl this year, you may remember that one of the biggest news stories was that the beautiful actress Scarlett Johansson, who is Jewish, was named global ambassador for SodaStream. SodaStream is an Israeli company with a major manufacturing plant in the West Bank city of Maale Adumim, which develops home carbonation systems that allow users to convert tap water into sparkling water in more than 100 flavors. After signing her contract with SodaStream, Johansson found herself under fire for supporting a company in the so-called occupied Palestinian territories. New York Magazine even referred to the company as blood bubbles. Eesh. Riza Aslan, a well-known writer and academic, called Scarlett Johansson a Nazi supporter for working with SodaStream. The confrontation didn't end then. The SodaStream ad Johansson appeared in played during the Super Bowl, but she ended up stepping down from her long-held post as global ambassador for the charity Oxfam due to a fundamental difference of opinion. In the days that followed, many argued that Oxfam was hypocritical and that the waves of protesters who began advocating for the boycott of SodaStream would hurt both Israelis and Palestinians. 900 Palestinians worked at the company's biggest plastics and metal factory in Maale Adumim, technically in occupied land. "Those who seek to help the Palestinians end up hurting us," said Nabil Bashrat, a resident of Ramallah who worked at the factory. "SodaStream provides income to hundreds of families, whole villages. Peace is what happens here inside and not outside. Those who are abroad don't understand the relations and actually sabotage the process. The factory draws us closer, even in times of instability, as during the war in Gaza, everything was usual here." Unfortunately for Bashrat and the other 900 Palestinian SodaStream employees, BDS supporters were more concerned with boycotting Israeli business than in helping actual Palestinian human beings. Well, the boycott supporters have their wish. SodaStream has announced that they are moving the Maale Adumim factory to land that undisputably belongs to Israel near the town of Lahavim in the Negev. That means that the Israeli company will no longer be, well, hiring or occupying in the West Bank. It means that 900 Palestinians, the people the BDS movement is trying to help, are now out of a job. The company will make the move in 2015. While it will still practice equal opportunity hiring practices, it is more likely that the region's Bedouin and African communities in the new area will get the benefits of jobs in place of the laid-off Palestinians. Maybe the BDS movement doesn't really help Palestinians after all. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish Rabbi Joseph Telushkin, one of the most influential authors and speakers on Judaism. His new book is called Rebbe, about the Chabad rabbi and about what is really the most dynamic organization in Jewish life over the past 20 or 30 years. You have written broadly about Jewish literacy, Jewish humor, Lashon Hara, ethical texts, inspirational texts, some of the not only best-selling but most influential Jewish books. Why did you decide to write this book now?
What happened was, a number of years ago, I had written an article on the anniversary of the Rebbe's death, in which I told the story that I had told earlier about his interactions with my father. But I came to understand something very unusual was going on. As is normally the case, when a movement has a charismatic leader, and the leader dies, so the movement becomes smaller. At best, it just hangs in there, but usually it becomes smaller, could even shrivel up. And the extraordinary thing was that in the aftermath of the Rebbe's death in 1994, and despite numerous predictions from pretty knowledgeable people that the movement was going to have a real crisis in terms of continuity, the movement started to expand, and expand quite exponentially. So that as of now, 49 of the 50 American states have Chabad houses. The only one that doesn't, since inevitably that thought will pop into people's head, is South Dakota. The 49th state to get one, which was only a few months ago, was Mississippi. And worldwide, Chabad now has representation in 80 countries. My friend Dennis Prager, a number of years ago, spent a Shabbat at the Chabad house in Phnom Penh, Cambodia. The largest Seder in the world last year serviced 1,100 people in Kathmandu, Nepal. So something extraordinary was going on in Jewish life. The movement didn't contract. The movement's been expanding. It's the first movement that I am familiar with in Jewish history that has made the effort to try and reach every Jewish community and literally every Jew in the world. And therefore, I thought, this is something worth spending a few years studying. This is a real phenomenon and a inspiring phenomenon.
You know, one of the fascinating aspects of it is, if you think about it, Chabad represents, in a way, a kind of pre-modern form of Judaism that isn't afraid to use all of the most modern means available to spread its message and to reach Jews.
That's very perceptive. You're right. That's an insightful point.
Mm-hmm. Was that Schneerson's concept? How did that evolve, do you know?
Yes, very much so. Well, you know, number one, unlike his rabbinic predecessors, and unlike the overwhelming majority of rabbis in the ultra-Orthodox, but in the Haredi world, the most traditional world, he had an extensive university education. And his area was in the sciences, and he always understood that there was no reason to fear that the sciences would in any way undermine one's religiosity. So he had answers to science, to challenges to religion. But he was very excited. Early on, under his auspices, Chabad started offering radio classes in Jewish texts, and some very traditional rabbis criticized that this was in the 50s, and they said, radio plays, you know, impure music, it does all sorts of inappropriate things, and to which the Rebbe said, radio is neutral, depends what it's used for. So later on he started having his talks broadcast video, or they had telephone hookups throughout the world. So Chabad has always been very quick, very willing to embrace modernity. And I've noticed since my book have come out, in addition to the copies sold in the conventional way through bookstores, thousands of copies of the ebook have also been sold. So they really see the whole world of science as neutral depends how it's used. As the Rebbe once put it in speaking to a young girl who'd asked him a question along those lines, he said, is a knife good or bad? You know, and the girl thought and said, well, it depends. Is it used to cut food or is it used to cut people? And that's exactly the point. If it can be used for good, so Chabad was very into utilizing it.
I want to talk about one other aspect of Chabad. I mean, it's an excellent book called Rebbe. Fascinating. It came out, by the way, basically the same time that is Dean Steinsaltz's kind of personal memoir called My Rebbe about Schneerson came out for the, I guess, 20th.
I'm honored to be in the company of Dean Steinsaltz. And what happened was my book, Rebbe, and his book, you know, both ended up coming up in very close proximity
right. To
the 20th anniversary of the Rebbe's.
The Rebbe's yard site, right? Well, yeah. I guess the 19th anniversary of his yard site, the 20th anniversary of his passing. But it tells you something fascinating that your book, that you and Steinsaltz, two of the real protean figures in the American Jewish landscape, literary landscape certainly, both wrote about the Rebbe at the same time, from very different perspectives. We used both of your books, by the way, in my book group, because they're so different. So I'd encourage people to get both.
Oh, excellent. Thank you.
One last question. You know, for those of us who are clearly not Chabad, but have friends who grew up Reform, conservative, secular, and everything else, who go to Chabad because they make it so welcoming, they make it so easy, there's no dues, and they involve people, and have seen it grow. There's something disturbing about seeing pictures of the Rebbe up in homes. I've seen wall hangings, weavings. This doesn't impress someone from a more secular background or a liberal Jewish background as being appropriate. How does Chabad deal with that kind of a question?
Well, for them, he represents... Look, I can't speak for all the people, and there are some people maybe it's inappropriate. But in general, he represents for them an epitome example of what a human being who devotes his or her life to goodness could achieve. A real example of someone on whom they want to model their life. One of the things I have in my book is seven virtues that they learned from the Rebbe, including anything worth doing. Now, we were all raised to believe anything worth doing is worth doing well. The Rebbe's real example, though, was anything worth doing is worth doing now.
What a great lesson. Anything worth doing is worth doing now. I want to thank Rabbi Joseph Telushkin for a fabulous visit here on Two Jewish. He'll be here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, next week. And details are available on that elsewhere in the show. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you. I look forward to seeing you, God willing, when I'm out.
Look forward to seeing you as well. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday morning at 9 o'clock when our guest will be Abigail Gumbiner, the daughter of the pioneering civil rights rabbi Joseph Gumbiner, exploring her father's remarkable career as a pioneer for equal rights for African Americans. Our playout this morning comes for the High Holy Day season. Rosh Hashanah is now just 2.5 weeks away, beginning September 24th. This is from the Western Winds for the coming High Holy Days. Write us in the Book of Life. Remember and inscribe us for a good year. B'Sefer Chaim. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.